Meditation.
Depending on the quality of my mind.
You know, there's good days and bad days. And good days as well.
Feel like the waterfall of thoughts. And every now and then, a nice calm.
I can't think of anything.
This is Meditation in the City.
The Shambhala New York Podcast.
And I'm Dave, your host, for now. Yeah. We're talking about impermanence. We're talking about things not lasting. Maybe I won't always be the host of the Meditation in the City podcast. Maybe the podcast won't always be here. Maybe the whole idea of a podcast will be a relic of the past. What do we do? How do we deal with the fact that things change, that things come to an end, that things are constantly shifting beneath us? That is the topic of today's talk by David Perrin. This is a great talk, and I'm glad you're here, and I'm glad that you're listening to this podcast in this moment before it all goes away. Poof. Visit us at ny.shambhala.org for all of our upcoming classes and retreats. I want to point out that Shambhala Training Weekend 1, which is our introductory meditation weekend, is happening July 7th, the weekend of July 7th. That's Friday night, Saturday, and half of Sunday, with Shastri Ethan Nickturn, contributor to the podcast. I'm sure you've heard him many times. This is a great opportunity to do that program with him the weekend of July 7th. Also, if you're feeling particularly ambitious, our 7-day meditation retreat is happening again this summer, the week of August 18th. Think about it if you'd like to experience a deeper meditation intensive experience. That is a great opportunity. For more information about those and other programs, visit our website, again, ny.shambhala.org. And now, here is David Perrin talking about impermanence.
So traditionally, impermanence is considered, among other things, one of the four or five, Phil was saying five reminders. What's the, there's five? Yeah. Okay, often talked about as four, but can be five reminders. And in that instance, without going into the details of what the others are, the important thing about impermanence as a reminder is, you know, there have been a number of teachings and very accomplished masters who've said that if you only had one practice to do in your life, that this would be the practice to do. And the reason that is, I think, and that's what the subject of this is going to be tonight, is that this leads us directly kind of right into the heart of what it means to be human. Impermanence as a given is something that we can all intellectually get behind, right? Is there anyone here that would disagree with impermanence? Does anyone here have the experience of something lasting forever and never ending, something that arose somehow and then just kept going? No, so this is right, it's a given. But this is what's interesting about meditation, is because we can have an intellectual understanding, we can have a view, we can read, and we can apply our own common sense wisdom and discernment. But the reality is that when things end, or we're anticipating things ending, it's hard, it's difficult. Anyone have that experience of when something ends, it's difficult? Did anyone ever go to Angelica Kitchen on 12th Street? So Angelica Kitchen closed. Right, exactly. Angelica Kitchen is closed for good. It closed about 3 weeks ago. It was in existence for 40 years. It was the mainstay vegetarian restaurant, probably known around the world, really, and probably the longest standing one in New York City. Does anyone have a restaurant or a food place that's like a home away from home? Like, if I'm not going to cook, I'm going to go to this place? Angelica was that for me. Like, I knew I was going to get the Dragon Bowl. the wee Dragon Ball with the soba sauce. I didn't have to think about it. If I didn't know what I was going to do for dinner, that was where I was going to go. So, oh, you know, like, what am I going to do without Angelica? I walk by it still, and I longfully, I look at the, you know, they still have the sign in the window, thanks for 40 great years. It's, I still can't believe it. Has anyone here recently ended a job? Within the last year, ended a job. You all have stable jobs. This is very good. Okay. You have experience with ending a job. I ended a job a few months ago. And it was, I was working for an agency that was placing me in schools as a counselor and therapist to students. So they were placing me around to different placements year to year. Sometimes I stay for a couple years. Sometimes I would stay for just 6 months or so. And my most recent placement was relatively short. So I wasn't there for even 6 months. But I decided to leave the agency altogether, so I wasn't going to be placed in any other school. So my going away party consisted of me throwing myself a going away party, buying cupcakes for all the kids that I was working with. So baked by Melissa, I had all these teeny little colorful cupcakes. The kids came, we did art, they gobbled up the cupcakes. A few of them gave me hugs. Some of them gave me a card saying, you know, we love you, thank you for everything, we're going to miss you. And then the day was over. And I never went back to that school. And I haven't seen any of them since. And I really haven't seen my colleagues that I worked in the agency since. So this is not a plug for them having thrown me a going away party, although it is a plug for them. I actually have a friend, Cindy, and she was trained as a celebrant. Have you heard of this tradition of celebrancy? So celebrants are people who are trained as, they're kind of like ministers, but it's more non-denominational, and they are trained to facilitate or hold the space, just like a minister or a pastor or something would at a wedding, for life transition events. So they help people craft this special ceremony for the end of a job, for the passing away of a loved one. Usually that is a funeral, but sometimes you want to do something that's more personal, for a graduation. And you actually get together and you create a ritual around that to celebrate and mark that occasion, which I think is a fascinating, particularly for the end of career, end of job situation. There, to create closure around something that you've probably invested a tremendous amount into. And when there's not closure, as there wasn't for me in the case of ending this job, totally, there was some closure, but we're left feeling a little bit of groundlessness. Have you ever felt that after something? Anybody ever broken up with someone? So here's this person, right? This partner in life, often a best friend. For me, it was my first love, and it was high school, or just after high school. We'd been dating in high school, and I had this kind of contentious relationship between her, my mother, and myself. And my mother, in her wisdom, saw that this relationship probably needed to end because it wasn't so healthy and sustainable, but I was completely enmeshed. I mean, this was like my boo. This was, you know, my person. And we didn't live in the same neighborhood, but I one day had this very emotional conversation with my mother, and she was like, you have to go do this. You have to go over to her house right now and knock on the door and break up with her. And I didn't know left from right. I was in love, but I also felt so connected to my mom and trusting of her. And so in a complete tizzy, I took the train, I walked over to her house, I knocked on the door, she opened the door, I said, we have to break up. And she was just like completely bewildered, didn't know what happened, and there was this moment of entire awkwardness, and then I just turned around and ran. We ended up communicating after that. We didn't ever date again, but the experience of the train ride home was of something having been ripped apart, Right, so we're starting to get to this idea of what impermanence feels like. The feeling and felt quality of impermanence. Intellectually, we all understand it. Would someone, like I did, ask you to sit on the cushion and think about beginnings and endings, there is implicit in that this idea of heartbreak, being torn apart from something, not knowing what's going to come next. I don't know if any of you had that feeling, if you were able to tune into that end of the breath, and sometimes there can be this quality of, like, what happens next? So in that space of ending, in that space of impermanence, there's both the unraveling of whatever we've kind of known to be true, or relationships, or who's who and what's what, all of that kind of disintegrates, and this particularly happens right when someone dies, who we're close to, and we go into that twilight zone of what's what, what's time, and where am I, and everything is opened up in this very interesting dimensional way. So it can be very destabilizing and scary, and we don't necessarily spend time thinking about, you could say, death. And then there's also the quality of, it is the ground for something new to emerge. And in fact, if there was never that space of death and impermanence, there would not be space for something new to emerge. So this is the interesting thing about noticing thoughts, right? Like, if you notice the beginning, middle, and end of thoughts, you can begin to see that the thoughts are not a solid wall. And new thoughts come in, and thank God they do. You'd be stuck playing that same loop, that you'd be stuck over and over and over and over. But something else happens. There's a shift because of impermanence. Something I like to think about, I had the flu recently, and you know, when you're really sick, and there may be a person in this room or multiple people who are chronically ill, there may be some of us that are close to dying. But whether that's the case or whether you experience illness or pain, physical pain or emotional pain, in certain instances where the pain is so overwhelming that there's not actually anything that you can do to mitigate that pain, there's only one thing that can provide relief, and that's impermanence. So we're going deep tonight, folks. I don't know if you got that sense, like, right, that you're probably like, why didn't I come to Shantae's talk last week, which is, why can't I meditate? All right, let's go even deeper, since we're just happened. Are you familiar? So I know so little about astrophysics that I'm going to talk about it. Neil deGrasse Tyson, do you know Neil deGrasse Tyson? He's a famous astrophysicist, head of the Hayden Planetarium uptown. So it's very fun to read him, and it's amazing the perspective that I get when I start to think about astrophysics. So do you know how a star is made? You're shaking your head. You were shaking your head. Yeah. Do you know how a star is made? So fusion with hydrogen and other elements, and there's a lot of pressure. Good. That's good. That's a definite. That was way more than I knew before I was thinking about this talk. Anybody else want to throw any tidbits in? Yes.
It forms because all the surrounding hydrogen comes rushing towards the center. It heats up and forms a hot ball. and it stays there like that, fusing for quite a while.
Right, so that thermonuclear fusion happens.
Right, but gravity keeps it into a ball, but the thermonuclear fusion pushes it out, and they're at equilibrium, and you get like a... You can tell what I do for a living.
Yes. So good. Hold the mic. You were going to finish that thought.
Oh yeah. So the suns, they last for quite a while. Then eventually they die and blow up.
Yeah. So we're going to talk about that.
Yeah.
So hold the mic because I want you to debunk or I want you to tell me where I'm totally off base. So based on what Neil tells me. There's these giant, before even that, you started at a certain point, but if we back up from that, there are these gas clouds, right, that are enormous. I had no idea that there were these clouds floating around space that are billions of times the size of most stars. Like, it's thought of that there could be 75, million suns in one single gas cloud. So there's these big behemoths that are just floating around.
Right.
And then what happens is that as they cool down, the atoms, so this is even maybe before the gases, but the atoms that are usually bouncing off of each other and going haywire within that cloud, the cooling down means they start to stick. And so with that sticking, we start to get the particles, and the particles actually absorb light. And that absorbing of light causes, it's interesting with gravity, right? The gravity is holding the thing together, but at a certain point, in order for the star to form, the cloud has to collapse into something that has its own...
And that's right, and the collapse is caused by asymmetric distribution of density. So it's like there's a dense area of the universe and of the cloud, and it draws in surrounding matter, and it rushes towards the center, and as it rushes, it speeds up, it heats up, and eventually you get a hot ball of gas.
And that hot ball of gas, that thermonuclear fusion, is what produces all these elements, right?
Eventually, that's right, almost all the elements.
All the elements up
through iron is made in the sun, and then when the sun explodes, the heavier elements are made as they collide into each other after the explosion.
So the sun explodes like a supernova. This
that
is
might
great.
Be two
supernova.
More,
I'm
must
so
be
glad
way
you were here. Did you pay? You get a free admission. The sun explodes. So we have a supernova. The sun explodes because the gas runs out?
Oh, because all of a sudden that star collapses and then explodes, typically.
Yes.
So, I mean, eventually it runs out of fuel. That's true. So it can't create as much heat as it did before. And then it can't push out away from gravity. You lose the equilibrium and it collapses
And it collapses and then it just...
And then after it collapses, it explodes and blows up some of the local planets that's orbiting the sun. It kind of fries them and turns them into,
Up local planets that are orbiting the sun.
Yeah. Like that.
Has your mind been blown yet?
Yeah. But the interesting thing is that that's where all the atoms in our body come from, and dead stars that died a long time ago.
So
all the elements that are heavier than hydrogen are made somewhere else, and eventually they came over here in a dust cloud, and we got the planet Earth. So that's the poetic part of it. We're made of stardust, so that's...
Yes, great.
It's very nice, isn't that?
it's great. Thank you. So tell me your name.
Oh, Frank.
Frank. Yes, round of applause.
So that was auspicious. Do you see why I like this as an analogy for an impermanence? Anytime I'm like getting annoyed because someone cuts in front of me when I'm trying to cross the street, and then it's like, oh, I'm made of stardust. I'm only here because there was a supernova that exploded somewhere and burned some planets along with it. Impermanence puts things in perspective. And when we can use meditation as the seat of being brave enough to go into the felt quality of what it means for things to end, what it means that everybody in this room will at a certain point be dead, then just as the person who was speaking earlier about this abundance of life, that it becomes illuminated, right? In the explosion of the star, it becomes illuminated how amazingly precious every single second of our life is. And that those practicing those small little endings, those little deaths along the way, is really an opportunity for life to enter more fully than it had an hour ago when you showed up here and you had no idea that we're going to be talking about cosmic destruction and death and... So we're going to talk about this in a moment, but I want to add one more layer into this because this is Shambhala, and we are always thinking about this spectrum of our own individual experience, our interpersonal experience with other human beings, and then I jumped all the way to the cosmic experience. So I went all the way, we went from the individual experience of hearing one sound at a time and noticing as that sound arose, abided and dissipated, and then we went all the way to the beginning of the creation of this planet and the end of the planet. So let's go a little bit more in the middle, but more towards the level of society, because we talk a lot about, in Shambhala, we talk about society and what it means that these teachings and meditation, how they reflect on and make us consider society. So that time when I was sick and I had the flu, one of the movies that I watched was Braveheart. Has anyone seen Braveheart? Okay, so this started getting me... we have a lot of Mel Gibson fans in the room, I know, tonight. This started getting me thinking about in that particular case, he plays William Wallace, who was very involved in the Wars of Independence in the late 1200s. So the Scottish gaining independence from the English. There's so many examples of studying and noticing when societies transition for good. And I think we're in a moment right now where this could be useful a little bit, to spend a little bit of time starting to contemplate what it means for society to transition for good. I was talking to my friend Adam, who's a teacher here in the Shambhala tradition, and he said to me, and it was the way he said it, he said, you know, when Rome fell and those senators or whoever they were sitting around drinking Prosecco and hanging out, and then the Visigoths and these Germanic tribes, the hordes, came in and knocked on the door and said, this is over. It just brought this image to my mind of, like, everything is going along, we're going along in our lives, and then there's a moment where it changes forever. And then there's also long transitions. So we are, again, in Shambhala, we're students of history, and so we like to look at different moments in history where what we would call enlightened rulership came to be. Right, so this is this imagining not only the ending, but what would you, if you were to envision a society, if you were to literally envision what would be the society after this one, how would we organize ourselves after this particular moment, this period in history? I think this is such a fascinating contemplation for all of us to be doing. So another example of this is in the 3rd century BCE, so we talk a lot about, or we study the teachings and the life example of Ashoka, who was the emperor in India at the time. And so here was a gentleman who was a very, we would say now he was a right-winger. He was very authoritarian. He was tyrannical almost in his clutch, and this was something he learned from his forefathers.
He had such a tight grip on trying to control society that he would go to war literally against people who were within his this kingdom. So there's a very famous battle, the Battle of Kalinga, where hundreds of thousands of people were killed. And it's said that whether it was in one moment or a series of moments, that Ashoka looked out and saw this destruction of human life and said, this can't, it can't be it. This can't be what it means to maintain safety and peace and control. At that time, Buddhism had only was actually this fledgling small institution. It was not very well known. And he fell in with some Buddhist teachers, and he began to study the principles of Buddhism, and he realized that he could have this epiphany and change his whole way of ruling. And historically, we know that's exactly what happened. He began to promote religious tolerance and freedom. He began to have schools and monasteries built around the country. He created these monuments to wakefulness and peace. So he completely went from being a killer to being a beneficent ruler, an enlightened ruler. And this was a time around history where Buddhism really got its foothold as a viable option in society. Do you know what I mean? Like, this was, society was built out of these principles that came out of Buddhism. Before him, no, not so much. It was more of a fringe thing. He made it a mainstream thing in that particular part of the world. The only reason we're sitting in this room tonight, hearing and learning about these things and meditating, is because the gentleman over my right shoulder, Chogyam Trungpa Rinpoche, he fled his home country of Tibet in, I believe it was 1959. He fled because of the communist invasion. And it had been slowly, the Chinese had been slowly occupying Tibet, and then it went into a full-fledged invasion. And pre this moment where Trungpa Rinpoche and many other esteemed Tibetan teachers left, I mean, if you had gone into Tibet 20 years prior to that, we would have probably experienced a medieval society. We would have experienced a society and a culture that felt like it was, we were living hundreds of years in the past. I mean, this determination, this fierce independence of the people living, and they were living, it was like a cultural treasury and storehouse that they've been cultivating for hundreds of years, where spirituality, again, spirituality and religion were infused with the way that the culture and the society was organized. And so people were doing practices like these in their homes. They were doing it in monasteries. There were people living settled agrarian lives. There were people who were nomadic. It was this whole rich tapestry of a culture that, again, there was someone knocked on the door and said, not anymore. And that way of life, I imagine, still exists in pockets, but it's been changed forever. It will never go back to the Tibet that cultivated these teachings for hundreds of years. So lest we take for granted that we're all gathering here tonight to discuss this and to practice these teachings, we can have a moment to recognize and appreciate how precious that opportunity is, not only in the world today, but in the course of human history. And also, we can open ourselves up to the possibility that this moment, not only just with doing these practices, but this moment in where we are in our human history will change, it will shift. And I don't know about you, but
my comfortable life changing is pretty damn scary. So as much as I bemoan some of the things that are going on in the world today and in the society, I'm equally attached to how comfortable I am. So in walks impermanence, which says, okay, sweetie, it's okay you're attached. Maybe we can spend a little time envisioning what this means to end, so that you don't have to be so scared of it and walk around avoiding it, which is what I do most of the time. And in essence, this practice can be seen as an opportunity, or as something, some you might use the word practice or discipline or endeavor, pastime, whatever, contemplation, whatever you want to say. Each breath is a practice of impermanence. So each breath, we're beginning to make some sense of peace with things coming and going. And that's very powerful. It offers us a lot. Sometimes I think that the peace and stability that we have is not that we found this place where nothing ever changes, it's that we're coming to terms with change, right? We're feeling change moving in and out. And so we're like, okay, this is the way of the world. This impermanence is the way things, it's the way of the world. It's the way things are. And I'm going with that. I'm not fighting that. I'm not fighting my mind. And so as we go with this current, rather than fight against it, I guess it's, I just thought of that analogy. Have you ever heard of the riptide, what you're supposed to do if you're in a riptide, you get caught in a riptide? You don't try to fight it and swim back to the shore. You relax and you go out, and then you just kind of try to go around the riptide. So you sort of tread, you allow it to take you out a little bit further, and then you tread around the riptide, the intensity of the riptide, and then you can kind of find the periphery of that riptide and you can come back to shore. But you have to relax, because if you panic and try to get back to shore, it's not good. So we're relaxing into impermanence here. It's a practice of relaxing into impermanence, however uncomfortable it might make us feel. Okay. We could have a little bit of discussion, comments.
I have practiced sporadically for a good part of my life, but a few years ago I realized I sort of hit a wall and I just needed to practice more consistently. And I started trying to swim to shore because I was afraid of letting go of the self. I felt like an operating system was being changed inside of me. And it was a pretty profound experience at first, because I've only begun to relax a couple years later, relax into it and learn to let things happen. Mm. And at first there was a real anxiousness and almost butterflies in my stomach that would come up. Because I was afraid to let go of the stories that I was telling myself of who I was. And the more I embraced impermanence, the more I began to realize this is freedom. This is a liberating act for myself. This is birthing and emerging. And so I've learned to relax more.
Good.
Yeah.
Good.
So
thank you so much.
Thanks for reminding me.
Thank you.
Hi. I have two questions, I guess, on impermanence. I guess the first one would be an interpersonal one. How do you deal with the relativity of impermanence? Meaning, like, for me, 2 weeks is a relative impermanent time, but for a child, 2 weeks is an eternity. You know, so how do you kind of impart that or deal with the same kind of vocabulary when you're dealing with someone else to kind of impart that? And the second one is, how do you kind of don't let the idea that impermanence is a fact of life lead to kind of complacency, mm-hmm. like in today, you know, like these policies are not going to be permanent. We should just be okay with it and not fight back. You know what I mean?
Yes.
Like that kind of thing.
Yeah. Very so good. Those are my two. Thank you. So for the first question, so I have kids and my daughter is 5, and recently my partner, Anne, who is her mother, June's mother, went away for just a couple nights. I think actually just one night, but two nights. And after the second night, June woke up that morning, and I went into her, and she was crying. And she said, I miss Mom. And she was saying it like she had been gone, like Anne had been gone for like a year. You know? And for her, for a 5-year-old, it's exactly what you're saying. 2 nights or a year, in that moment, she just, and I found myself also, I felt her feeling. And I had tears. And I said to myself, just be with the feeling of what it feels like to miss someone so deeply. And breathe into that. And I thought, you know, when I was a kid, it wasn't always the case, because it was very easy and understandable, maybe for my parents or others in those moments, or babysitters or caretakers, to be like, she'll be home soon, it's okay, she actually hasn't been gone that long, to go through this litany of, like, it's okayness. And I thought, I'm not going to do that. From my practice, I had the wherewithal to just be with how it felt. And not only cradle her, but allow myself to miss Anne the way she was missing Anne. And the way that I can just long for people. So I think that is maybe a little bit of a hint, and why we do the practice is to be in those moments and not necessarily convince someone of impermanence, but actually go into their sense of whatever it is that they're longing for and really be present for that longing and not try to change it. Maybe the most profound thing we can do in that moment is not try to change someone's experience and really, really bring in that longing into ourselves. Your second question is, I think it's why I chose to speak about the societal element tonight, is because when my friend Adam was telling me, brought up this notion of the fall of Rome, and I was like, I don't know shit about the fall of Rome. Like, what are you talking about? They didn't expect the Germanic tribes to show, you know, like, what was going on? But he was speaking about it in the context, so he was sort of saying, we were talking about Shambhala, and we were saying, we could start to now envision what it will be like post a society that is filled with speed, aggression, divisiveness, everyone out for themselves, everyone trying to capitalize on every little last thing. And if we don't envision that society and what it actually might look like in terms of to be in harmony with our environment, to create up systems of exchange that don't depend on purely on cash, to envision modes of organizing ourselves, even just on the local level of to share resources. If we don't spend any time envisioning that, then it will be hard for it to come to fruition. And when we can spend a little time, and there are some people who are in this room who are working hard on creating those solutions, but may have not actually given themselves the time to really envision what it will be like when they come into, you know, some people are so into action mode, I've got to counter what's happening in society, it's not spending a little bit of time envisioning what will it actually be like. And what do I have to give up? like, I like City Bike. You know, or whatever it is, or going out for a nice, I mean, do I have to give that stuff up? Does this mean that we're all of a sudden going to start sharing? Is it really socialism, or is it something else? You know, if we don't ever entertain those questions for ourselves and contemplate on that, we'll never figure out what it is that we do actually need to start to do and engage in. So it's not about complacency, it's about vision. Does that make sense? Yeah.
I wanted to talk about his first question in talking about not needing to console your daughter necessarily.
Mm-hmm.
And it made me think that impermanence is kind of the consolation in that moment.
Mm.
You know that she's going to feel better.
Right.
And you know that your wife's or your partner is going to come home. And so the impermanence of that and just... You're being with the missing of her, but you're also being with the impermanence, because it's what solves this, not solves, but it's just the fact of the situation.
Yeah, that's very well said. And you know what's so interesting about that is the way what you're pinpointing is that's true. And even a 5-year-old knows that that's true, right? That it's true that the feeling is going to pass through her and that something's going to change. Hopefully she will see her mother again, but that there's a fluidity to that situation. If I come up with some construct around consoling her, that's just an idea.
Mm.
It's all it can be. It can be a really good idea, like, oh, she's got a plane flight at such and such a time, but that's just an idea. I'm just creating something to buffer against the feeling. So that's what's so interesting about going with impermanence and being with another person in that moment of impermanence is that this is what's true. This is going to end. And even when we are with lying next to our lover, who we maybe can't ever imagine parting with, that is going to end. And so the feeling that arises with that and being able to weather that feeling and move through it, because we know in meditation that we'll move through that, particularly using our breath, is we're honing in on what's true, and that's what's the ultimate consolation. But we spend a lot of time creating false constructs or seemingly real constructs to buffer ourselves against impermanence. So you're absolutely right. You're opening up to what's true and real, and that is what deep down we all want. But we don't have a lot of practice with it.
Yeah, and you're kind of teaching your child that.
She was teaching me and I was teaching her,
right?
Because within 5 minutes she was like, "What's for breakfast?"
Exactly.
It was Saturday. She was,
she
I want,
forgot
I want
about
to watch
it
my shows. Yeah, yeah. And what do we have? Are you making pancakes?
Thank you.
Okay, I think that's actually a really nice place to stop talking about pancakes. thank you very much for coming tonight, and we have some nibbles out there. Please enjoy. If you can, feel free to continue these wildly deep conversations with people that you don't really know, or not. But please keep practicing, practice impermanence, and practice becoming awake in the midst of not easy circumstances. Thank you.
It's over. The podcast is over. For now, we'll be back next week. Thanks, David Perrin. That was cool. That was a great talk about impermanence. Not a light subject, but I enjoy talking about it, thinking about it. Visit our website, ny.chimbala.org, for more information about classes, weekend retreats. If you happen to live in a different city, there's probably a Chimbala Meditation Center near you. Just look us up. But if you are in the New York City area, come say hi. Visit our weekly Dharma gathering. It happens every Tuesday night at 7 o'clock. You'll feel at home there, I'm sure of it. Meet other people, meet the teachers. It's a good time. Email us at podcast@chimbalanyc.org. Your questions, comments, suggestions. And we'll see you next time. Later.